Welcome back to the Howarth Timber and Building Supplies 1840 podcast. I'm your host, Paul Bullivant, and today our episode features our very first customer, and that's Chris Allen. Welcome.
All right.
Chris, thanks for coming aboard. Real interesting story with Chris. We've been planning a customer episode even before we started the whole podcast, and Chris messaged us straight after seeing the first episode to say, would there be any chance I could come and get involved?
Yep.
Little did he know that we would snatch his offer up and get him straight in this because we'd be looking for a customer. So it was a really timely one, Chris. So thank you for coming.
No, just thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about Chris's career. He's got a really interesting career that's led him into the trade. We're going to talk about his current business, which is Catio King. And then we're going to finish off by trying to get your thoughts on what you really think about builders merchants.
That's
the good, the bad, and the ugly. We're particularly interested in learning from you.
Yeah.
So bizarrely, what we're more interested in is the bad and the ugly rather than the good. So that's it for today. So do you want to start with introduction?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Right, over to you then.
Yeah, so living in Doncaster. And that's where business is based, although I work all over the UK.
Okay.
If it's feasible, I've been up to Scotland for work, down West Country, down Folkestone, you name it, it takes me all over the place. You know, try to shrink that radius because it's nice to get home at the end of the day and have my tea. But, you know, if I have to stay in a hotel and have a microwave jobby, then that's it, you know. But, there we go. But wasn't something I thought I was going to ever do, if you know what I mean. It was kind of, get me joining the qualifications after army.
So just like that, I've probably stitched you up here, and I should say, let's start right back at the beginning.
Right at the beginning, right.
Let's start right at the beginning.
Right, okay.
Before you went into the trade, you were in the army.
Yes, that's it, yeah.
What took you into the army originally?
Right, so there's a long heritage of, family being in armed forces. My dad were Royal Marine, my mum were Women's Royal Naval Service. My dad's twin brother, he were RAF.
And then all the forces then between
it's tri-service on, all the way there's going really far back. There's family that have been in there for we've been in both world wars and all sorts, so it's
in the blood.
Yeah, well that's it. And it's as a little lad I always wanted to do it anyway. We're always what we're doing it, we're playing army and all that sort of stuff anyway. It just got to a natural point where I thought, before I get any older I need to get it done. So
what age did you sign up?
24.
Okay. Old.
Yeah, so I left it a bit. I mean, I'd moved out. I'd been into higher education. I'd started doing my music degree. I got to first year point in that, and I was just like, I need to do it now. This is not doing it for me.
So it was a degree you were doing?
Yes. Yeah. So it were my music degree, because I play bass, guitar.
Okay.
And I just, I wanted to go up that career path, but it just started like petering out and getting boring. I just thought, I absolutely love music. It's every day, it's there, but I just thought, I need to do the armed forces thing before I get any younger.
So you left for uni?
Yes.
Into forces at 24?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Complete culture shock.
<'Cause> that surprised me.
Yeah, because I'd gone from having, long hair and smoking and all that sort of stuff to, I need to be able to do a mile and a half in under 10 and a half minutes and so many sit-ups, so many press-ups, all that sort of stuff, and it were just... Yeah, it was an uphill struggle to settle, but got there at the end. Yeah. So, yeah.
And where did the army take you?
So we were based in Wiltshire. Yeah. As much as a recruiter wanted me to go to Coldstream Guards because of my height.
Okay.
But when he went off to make his photocopies for the paper, I scribbled it out and put Yorkshire Regiments. So, that were a good move on my part.
And the Yorkshire Regiments based out of Wiltshire?
They used to be. Because of Salisbury Plain and all that sort of stuff, the battalion I went to at 3rd Battalion, Duke of Wellington's, which is an armoured infantry regiment. So Salisbury Plain is basically where we do all the exercising. Yeah. But now they're all based, but, back up north, where we belong. Yeah. After I left, So, thanks for that.
So you do all your training?
Yeah. So training, we're up at Catrick Garrison. Yeah. Biggest garrison in Europe. Yeah. 6 months there, and then that were it. Off to battalion to start doing. Well, we basically got straight to pre-deployment training for Afghanistan.
Okay.
So it were a busy time.
I can imagine.
It was a very, very busy time.
Is that when would that have been?
So that was 2009. when I left training.
Yeah. Is that was I've kind of lose track of the timing of the Gulf Wars and time in Afghanistan. Where was 2009 towards the end of?
It was right when there was like a period in between, because it was quite kinetic around that point. So there were certain tours, like the tour in Afghanistan is referred to as Operation Herrick, but we just call it Op Herrick.
Okay.
Around like Op Herrick 10, 11, that sort of thing. It was getting quite kinetic. Lots of casualties from different units, all that sort of stuff. So that's when we were building up to ours, which was Op Herrick 16. So there's still quite a few tours to go before we actually got there. But, you know, we always had that in mind that as soon as we got there, we were going to be mega busy.
Right into the middle.
Yeah.
In fact, we've got some pictures of you in Afghanistan, if Dave can put them up.
Yeah. There we go. That's me on the Husky. That's that armor vehicle is referred to as a Husky.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Very, space is at a premium inside these vehicles, no matter which one you're in, whether you're in the Husky or in the big one called the Mastiff. But fortunate for me, because I was a gunner, that was my role. So whether
you were the one with your head out of the top.
Yeah, well, that's it, you know, because it was better aircon for a start, you know, and I didn't have to, yeah. You don't have to talk to anybody. You stick your head out the top and that's it. You're providing security, your eyes and ears for the vehicle.
Did you ever get shot at?
Not on the vehicles, no, unfortunately. But we did in the patrol base a couple of times, but it was very sporadic. And
I think we've got just the next picture, Dave. I guess that's you out on patrol.
It is, yeah. Yeah, we were just about to pull into a Afghan National Police Station there. So we used to do partner patrols where we'd basically just go out, do a show of force, just let Taliban know that we were out in the area, and, you know, if they wanted to come and have a go, then, you know, they were welcome to it. But then we'd patrol to these these police stations, and we'd just go and see them, see how they are, see if they needed anything, see if there's anything we could do, see if they wanted to come out and do a little patrol with us as well. But yeah, we did absolutely all sorts when we went out on foot like that. So it were a very mixed bag. We'd either go out on vehicles sometimes, or we'd just go out on foot, you know, either or really.
I'm assuming it was scary at times.
It was at first, yeah. The first time I went out was when, well, basically I just got dropped off by heli at the PB, at the patrol base. I'll try not to use acronyms, but it's one of them things. We got dropped off by heli, literally just all my stuff was still in a pile, and it was three rifles, I believe, the unit that we were basically doing a relief in place for. They had personnel that was sort of like still there that kind of gradually left theatre, and we gradually phase in, and then you sort of like interlink and they take you on patrol and say, right, you know, we've had issues with this firing point or this building, or this is a known area for IEDs, and they basically just familiarise us with the area and then basically leave us to it. Yeah, they were like, we need some gunners for vehicles, so I was just like, well, I'm here now, so I'm going to
do something.
Yeah, but as soon as I left the gate, I mean, the top of the turret was there, the bottom of the helmet was there, you know, it was just, yeah. But then
I can't imagine what it's, you know, what it's like.
It's, I don't know, it's a nervousness I've never experienced before, but you soon get used to it. You get comfortable. It's like when you go to someone's house for the first time, you're like, it's very unfamiliar and you're not sure what to expect. I mean, it's like, you know, I've never done a podcast before, so weren't sure what to expect. But
I hope this isn't as difficult as the first time you stuck your head out as a gunner.
Well, hopefully no one's going to take a pot shot.
Yeah. put your gun away, Dave.
No, you soon get used to it, you know, and you have confidence in your team. You know, and what you're out there to do, and you quickly just focus on what you've got to do. You know, if worst case happens, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. But you know that the guy to your left, the guy to your right, they're going to be there for you no matter what. Okay. So yeah, so
did when you're out on foot patrol, did you come across IEDs very often? Because that you know, as a civilian and just kind of reading and watching films, the thought of IEDs just. He's almost unreconcilable.
It's weird because if you see one, then 9 times out of 10, you're meant to see it. It's because they're very sort of like cheeky with the way they do things. They'll generally...
Cheeky is probably an understatement.
Yeah, I mean,
device that's meant to kill.
I know. Well, that's it. Well, it might not even be a real one. It might be a dummy one.
Okay.
Because they'll sometimes they'll put them out and they'll let you find it, And then you think, right, well, everybody's got to go and tech core while we deal with this and do it like a fingertip search, because that was one of the things that we had to do. If you did find something, you had to confirm it was an IED. So
when you're trained to do that?
Yeah, everybody was trained to do searches.
It wasn't, you didn't bring another team in to do
this? No. Well, if we did get a find and then somebody did a fingertip search and confirmed it was an IED, then that's when we basically put a cordon out and then we'd get another call sign in, which would be like engineers or something like that, and they basically come and deal with it.
Okay.
But then we just basically push into a security role and basically stop people getting in.
Yeah.
But you know, civilians are always, you know, they were on motorbikes over there all the time, and they're just weaving in and out of your cordon and not listening to you. You've got about 10 kids on bike as well and all the shopping and all that, and they just don't care. They don't care there's a 40 kilo device, you know, or out like that. But we'd either do that or we'd do what's called mark and avoid, where get a 10-figure grid reference of where it is, and then we basically just mark it with some sort of, whether it's like spray paint or something else, and basically just go around it and avoid it, you know.
What was life like in camp? Because I guess whenever you go out, you've got all those heightened emotions and senses and that going on. And then I guess back in camp, there's boredom, there's not a lot to do.
Yeah, it's...
What was life like there?
Well, you're getting off patrol. Straight away, you'd have like a post-patrol brief, all that sort of stuff. If you picked up any intelligence or anything like that, then that'd get processed straight away. We used to take this thing out on patrol called a hide camera, which basically had a fingerprint scanner, a retinal scanner. So it would, scan people's retinas, right. Take the fingertips, would have a chemical kit, so we'd basically swipe the fingertips in the hands, and if it came up a certain colour, it meant they'd been handling things like ammonium nitrate or the gunshot residue, and then we'd basically, you know, we'd send that up and they'd get, you know, captured basically and tactically questioned, it's called. But yeah, all that would get dealt with, and then patrol commander, whether it's corporal, sergeant or whoever were taking patrol, they'd just be like, right, that's it. Nothing more for you, thin out, go do your admin. So, yeah, we'd just strip out his kit, go get showered, make sure that weapons were unloaded but then made safe. So, you'd got like a magazine on or a belt or ammunition, but the weapon wasn't made ready, but it was always good to go because you couldn't go anywhere without a weapon. You just weren't allowed to. Even if you're going to shower, you know, you got a towel, your shower gel, and then general-purpose machine gun in your hand.
in case of attack.
Yeah, well, that's it because, you know, if something, you know, if grenades do start coming off a wall or whatever, at least you're armed, you know, that sort of stuff.
So could you ever relax then? If you've always got a gun with you, whatever you're doing?
It's weird because you didn't relax if you didn't have your weapon, because that's the first thing you'd be thinking.
It became your safety blanket almost.
Yeah, basically, because, well, one of the things I had to do when I got back home was getting up in restaurants and then walking back to my table thinking I've left me LMG, my light machine gun, and then thinking, I mean, Frankie and Benny's.
Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, little things like that gradually just fade out. But, yeah, it was very boring. Once you got done, that was it, unless you had some taskings for you, like Sergeant Major, just be like, we've got some ammunition that needs moving, or we've got some time bags that need filling or whatever. You're left to your own devices, and then that's when, you know, devil makes work for idle thumbs, whereas I started taking apart pallets and things like that, because we used to get as resupplies from helicopter or trucks that used to come in. Everything used to come on pallets, so I used to strip them down, save the timber, save the nails. I used to make stuff, you know, like furniture or weapons.
Was that tough then? The quiet times when you'd nothing to do.
Yeah, because it's not just a case of getting bored. You start thinking as well. You start thinking about home. Whereas I compartmentalised everything. I took family. I took friends. I basically just put it in a box and I just shut the lid and I put it to the back of my mind. You know, I'd write home, we'd send what are called blueies, where you'd go to the welfare suite, write your letters on a laptop, and basically your family and friends would get like a blue self-sealed letter that used to come through post.
Yeah.
Or you could physically write one and send one in a blue envelope. So yeah, you'd send blueies home. But apart from that, you found stuff to do.
Was that mind chatter a problem? So when you've been out on patrol, heightened senses, heightened awareness, heightened worry, concern, panic, come back, decompress, and then you're left. So that voice that we've all got in our heads, just chattering away to us. Was that hard?
It, It was, for me personally, it was once we started taking casualties, because then you start thinking, you start going, you keep replaying that situation and thinking, should I have done that? Should I have done this? Why didn't I notice that before? You know,
and did you have casualties in your patrol, or do you mean casualties wider in the base?
So we, in the patrol base for us was a central hub. So it was patrol base one or PB one, we used to call it. So that was like the central location for Alma Company, which was our company. And then around that, we had little satellite places called checkpoints. So we'd have like, there was one called CP Torah, CP Shikar. There was a couple of CPs that were manned by Afghan National Army, who we used to go up and visit periodically as well. Because they were no more than 800 metres away, some of them, but they were like literally a lot further out into the green zone. So that's, they were the ones that we did take casualties, unfortunately.
So even casualties that were not really close to you,
yeah,
it would still play on your mind a lot that you were.
Yeah, of course it would, because I mean we acted as a QRF where we took casualties at checkpoint Tora, and that was right at the end of the tour, like 5 weeks to go. It was a what's called a green on blue. So it was a Afghan policeman basically that opened fire on the lads whilst they were, you know, inside the checkpoint, which was, you know, it's just one of those risks, and unfortunately it's what happened to us. And that's like when I say you go over things all the time, like, you know, why didn't I notice that, all that sort of stuff. The copper that did it was someone that I worked with every time I did see him, because I went and did my language course, like a low level language course that was given out to certain ones that passed a certain criteria, because it was it provided another facet for people on patrol to gather low-level intelligence. Okay. So I could then ask people like, who is that? Or where is the IED? Is this dangerous? You know, all that sort of stuff. So I used to tag along with this guy, you know, and he used to teach me little bits, taught me how to write my name in Pashto and all that sort of stuff, and developed a rapport with him, which is why, like, I still think to myself, you know, should I have
just spotted it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, even though I wasn't there when it happened, I was on the quick reaction force that got sent to deal with it once it came over the net that, you know, that took casualties. But yeah, that's my sort of like the thing that I've got to deal with, is just looking around thinking, should I have noticed something? Boys,
that's tough to have that thought in you. How long were you there for?
Six months. Yeah, so it was April to October 2012 for us.
If you had your time again and looking back at it,
yeah,
would you go, if you had the choice, looking back, would you go again?
Again? Oh yeah, 100%.
So you don't regret going and experiencing and seeing some of the things that you...
No, it's, you'll find a lot of lads and lasses who've done operational tours and all that. You'll find, you know, the vast majority of them will just be like, you know, if they were offering to go tomorrow, I'd go.
Okay.
But it's a very simple existence being on operations. It's, you know, there's no, you know, you don't have to deal with the everyday stuff that you have to deal with at home. You know, you're not getting, you know, spam calls, dealing with bills. Okay. Thinking, oh, I've got to go get some bread, or, you know, car's got to go to garage on Monday. I've got, you know, am I going to, you know, work with that and all that sort of stuff. You literally, you know, you get up, you have your breakfast.
And do what you
go and
tell to do.
Yeah, go what you need to do. And it's so distilled and simple. It's almost blissful sometimes.
What did you learn about yourself in that 6 months?
I learned a lot about resilience and adaptability, because... I mean, not only was it like, you know, got to like 55 degrees at some point, you know, it's great for dieting, by the way. Osprey diet, the body armor we used to wear was called, you know, Osprey body armor at the time. And the Osprey diet really does work. I mean, I went 13 stone, come back 11 stone.
It was two stand.
Yeah, because it's just, you know, the amount of work you're doing, you know, out on patrol for like 9.5 hours carrying anything up to like 100 odd pounds.
So just going back to the resilience thing,
yeah,
that's a really good trait across life and business and everything. What did you learn about yourself that you were more resilient and could bounce back from things better than you thought you could?
Yeah, it's The resilience came from realigning perspective about what's important. So before, when you'd be at home and you'd be worried about things that might, you know, that were sort of trivialish, you get back and you think, you know what, that's not actually that important I'm worrying about anymore. And it kind of triages what you worry about, if you know what I mean. It's
it changes that mindset. So
yeah, it does. Yeah,
I once had I'd been on a training course with a guy, and he talked a lot about the mindset of it is what it is.
Yeah.
So worry about what you need to worry about.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't need to have to worry about everything equally.
There's that's stuff it.
That's just
all the chaff can wait. You know, there's, you know, he just he made me really sort of like look at what's important and what's not. But the flip side to that is going out into the supermarket. Little trivial things had really start to get on your nerves
when you came back.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on to that.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued with how you get back into like normality.
Yeah.
How did it come to an end? You just after your 6 months there, you just run your time in the forces, and it was time to come out.
Yeah. Basically, I mean, it was we came back October. Yeah. We had a nice big wedge of leave. There's something called op reset, which you get to do, which is like loads of adventure training. So you could go, some of the lads went scuba diving and surfing in Bali, some went skiing in Bavaria.
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. Unfortunately, I did, I put my name down for skiing and that and surfing and all that sort of stuff, but I ended up not doing it because I was being accused at the time of doing it to deliberately not spend time with, you know, a partner at the time, and I just caved and I thought, you know what, I can't be doing my ear bashing, so I just, you know, but I should have done it, you know, because it's part of the reset, not
decompressing.
Decompressing, that's it. Yeah, it's all part and parcel of just trying to bring you back down to, you know, back down to earth, because you do some decompression in Cyprus in a place called Bloodhound Camp, where there's a section of beach that's fenced off to everybody else. It's literally just for us to use as, you know, free ice cream, all sorts, and you literally just go on beach, there's inflatables, there's all sorts, you name it, and you just you just chill, you know, barbecues at night, have some beers, and just come back down to earth, basically. But yeah, it's
and what was that decision to come out? So the tour ended.
Yes.
Why come out of the forces at that point? You'd done what you needed to do.
Yeah, basically. I mean, you've got to do 4 years by law,
Your
minimum service, but it was a natural stopping point for me.
You've done your 4 years.
I mean, I've
scratched that itch that's come from the family and been in there for change.
And it was, but also it was my 4 years wasn't quite up, but the army was making redundancies at the time. So everybody that was on long-term medical downgrade, whether they got injuries or whatever, they were getting basically just, you know, let go. People were getting posted internally or externally, so they'd either go to another company, they'd get another job somewhere else in the battalion somewhere else, or they would get posted to another unit. So some of them went to paras, some of them went to guards, whether they liked it or not. Me personally, I applied for early termination, so instead of doing a year in hand where you do what's called the 7 clicks, because that's how many clicks it takes to get from start to finish for the application process to finally sign off. So 12 months from when you do your 7 clicks, but mine was 3 months because early termination was accepted.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, come May 2013, I was out on the street, twiddling my thumbs like, right, what was that?
So you got a plan when you came out? Do you know what you wanted to do?
Well, I know I wanted to go to college under joinery, because the day after I went to college and started joinery, even though the course had already started.
Why joinery?
Because I'd already got a familiarity with it.
Okay. Yeah, you were talking about breaking pallets down, and
that's it. It's, you know, people coming to me to ask them to make furniture, and I'm all making weapon racks for cookhouse. So because instead of just putting your weapon on the floor or something like that, the place would get cluttered with weapon systems. So built a lot of racks so people could stand them up, you know, and they're all centralizing. We're just a bit.
Had you been into joinery then? Before the army?
Yeah. It was ever since I was a little kid.
Where had that come from?
Oh, me dad, grandpa, stepdad, you name it, friends, dads, they were all, everybody back then were handy. You know, they could turn their hands to anything.
Yeah.
And so I used to just busy myself in a garage and just make stuff, whether it were little ships, castles, anything. You know, I'd just do it and I'd spend hours in there. But I'd also get taught how to use the tools, what they were supposed to do, what you shouldn't do with them,
okay.
You know, and ones not to touch at all.
that's where the joinery all started.
Yeah.
Then in the army, just to keep yourself entertained.
Yeah.
You were making all these things out of pallets.
Yeah, that's it.
That could be a nice little sideline for you, because there seems a big market for distressed pallet furniture. And
it makes me cringe when I see it. Because, I don't know, it's just, they get upsold a lot for what they are. And especially when you see people making decking out of pallets and stuff like that, I'm just like, you know, if that's what you want to do, then that's what you want to do.
That's your thing.
Yeah.
So you come out the army, you think, man, I'm going to be joining, going to college. How did going to college go? Because I would assume you'd have been at college, what would you be, late 20s?
I was 29.
And there'd be a lot of youngsters.
Yeah, there was a lot.
That must have been a clash.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I paid for my college tuition straight. I mean, I saved a lot of money when I was in the army. That was one of one of the good things that I did. I didn't go downtown and, you know, spend it all, you know, beer and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, paid for that, and it was only 2 days a week, and it generally wrapped up about 2 o'clock, where I was there until, like, the technician went home, you know, just doing absolutely all sorts. I'd finish all my projects mega early,
yeah,
and then I'd start building, like, a nest of tables or something like that, or whatever. But, yeah, the mentality of some of these, like, younger students was just...
Wait, these kids, he's going to college versus you, who's put your life on the line. Of course, it must have been a real...
There were one or two that had a great mindset, you know, they were there to learn, and then there were the other ones where parents told them to go, and they basically just turned up and they'd make, like, you know, little boxes to stash whatever in, yeah, and then that's it, and then they just go and just disappear all day, and, you know...
How did you handle that?
Not very well, unfortunately. I did have a couple of clashes sometimes where I'd be working, I'd have Led Zeppelin on some headphones or something like that, and some of the turnt radio on in workshop on, like, really loud, and then go and disappear around back and have a smoke or something. So I'd go and turn it off.
Yeah.
Carry on making me sash window or whatever, and then they come back, turn it back on. I'd turn it off, and then, you know, technician have to step in and separate it, because it was going to
get out of hand.
Yeah, but it was just like... Yeah, it was dealing with that mentality of, like, you know, you're here, why don't you just make the best you can make of it? And if it's not for you, then it's not for you, you know, but don't get in my way. Do you know what I mean? And it were tough to deal with, because I went there with an end state, and I wanted to do as well as I could and make a career from it.
So you go to college, assuming you saw it out, got your qualification.
Mm-hmm.
What were the qualifications?
So it was, the first one was MVQ level 2 in site carpentry, and then the next one was the level 3. So it was, like, you know, back to back. I didn't do the level 1 because it was the basis. They said, like, you know, you obviously where a saw is and all that sort of stuff. So because I joined the level 2 after it started, they basically said, right, make me, you know, one of these joints, make one of them joints. And they basically just looked in and just thought, yeah, he knows what he's doing.
So you got your qualifications. Then I suppose you just went into the workplace.
Whilst I was doing the course Monday, Tuesday, I got in touch with a mate of mine who's ex-Royal Engineer. He's been self-employed, multi-skilled, you know, whether it's plumbing, plastering, electric, joinery, you name it, it can do it. Laboured for him for a while. And then come 2015, when I was coming to the end of the course, that's when I joined the Army Reserve.
Yeah.
And that's when I got put onto my mate Joe, who's a roofer by trade, but he does all sorts as well. And he took me on, and I stayed with him for, must have been about 5 years, I think. And that's where I basically started doing my joinery, working with joiners that he's as employed on regular, and that's where I really started to learn. It's like driving, you know.
You learn the basics, and it's experience.
Yeah.
So you're doing that. You've told me this story, and it's part of the story of you. What was the stroke of fate that got you into the cat industry?
Yeah, right. So there's a mate of mine I've known since I were young. She lives in Liverpool. Got to know her dad really well as well as a consequence of that. And he got in touch with me and he's like, oh, you're doing your joinery at the moment, aren't you? I've got a customer in Barnsley because, you know, it's out of area for him. And he's like, you know, she wants this cat-proof netting fitting. He says, it's, you know, it's easy to install. You know, you'd easily be able to do it. Would you want to do it for me? So I was like, well, yeah, fine. I'll do that. And that was my first sort of like cat-based job, really, you know. So
and this
that
is,
was it.
This is netting that goes over normal garden fencing to stop cats.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so it's a company called FeelySafe. Cat-proof fencing that basically angles inwards. The cats can climb up to the apex of the brackets and the netting, but then they can't go any further. But you do get like certain breeds that can climb upside down, but then you just there's additional stuff you can fit to it to mitigate that. But yeah, that was basically the open door basically into the cat sort of sector of this industry.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I'm telling you, I didn't realise there was a cat-based element to the joinery.
Well, I didn't until about 5 years ago.
We'll talk more about it.
Yeah.
So you randomly help out a friend, do a job for them that's just out of area for them.
Yeah.
You do it.
Yeah.
At what point of that did you go, flipping it, there's a cat-based part of this industry, a niche that I could join?
Well, it was like, you know, the more and more started becoming apparent because as I spoke to like Steve and Alan, his business partner, about it, they asked me if, you know, would you be willing to travel a bit more? And then it got to the point where like, right, do you want to do the installation for us and we'll just provide the kits and all that sort of stuff? And as that got more and more, there were occasions where I was working with Joe, he's like, we ain't going to work on next week. And I was just like, you know what, that works fine for me. Yeah. And eventually it got to a point where I just, you know, I said to him, like, you know, I've got loads of work on. I'm going to go and do this for a bit. And that with that. Really, and then basically just traveling UK fitting this fence top system for him. But he got to the point where Steve got in touch and he's like, you know, this lady, she wants a garden cat proofing, but it's not suitable for the netting. But you can build her a catio, and I was just like,
so here we go, catio.
Yeah, I was just like, I'll be honest, me Italian's not that good, so I don't know what that means. I don't know where a catio is. So what is it? And he basically explained what it is. Show me some pictures. I thought, yeah, I can do that.
Right. So the first obvious question.
Yeah.
Because until I met you,
yeah,
I not got a clue what a blooming catio was.
Yeah.
And I have to say, we did our visions before I met you.
Yeah.
Or was going to be a strange cat man. Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to know that you're just dead normal.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that.
Well, normalish. Yeah. So you've gone on to set a business called Catio Kit. So yeah. What you want me to do is answer the question of what is a catio, and to help us, you've kindly sent us through some pictures, which will hopefully help you describe today. Can you put some pictures up for
us? Yeah. Right, so this one.
It's also catio.
So this is a catio base. So this is one of mine that I recently did. Enclosure, 100% cat proof. Let your house cats out. They can experience the outside world, get that enrichment. They can climb. They can just do what cats do best, whether that's hide in these boxes or, you know, express their claws on the scratch poles, get some exercise and just experience what it's like to be outside, but not get stolen, you know, run over, poisoned, you know, all that sort of stuff. But it's also a space for everybody because, I mean, like that chair that the customer's got there, it's going to be the prime spot for, you know, when you get a bit of rain and so on, you can sit out there with your brew, your cats are climbing everywhere, and it's just it's a family space at the end of the day because they're not just pets, the members of family. I really enjoyed doing this one because that box especially was a lot bigger than what I normally do, so it allowed me to put a lot more silhouettes into it. And also you can see like there's a little handrail at the top.
Yep.
That's because the two of the cats were brothers and they're both epileptic. So the client was worried that if they did have a fit on the top level and they fell off, they're worried about injury. So that's why I build them 100% bespoke, because little things like that, you can just add it into it.
Where do you come up with all the little bits and pieces, the climbing rails and the different levels? Is it just some things that you've just come up with?
Just make them. When I first started out, I was looking for inspiration online because there's a lot of companies in the US. But I basically just looked at what people were doing, what people weren't doing, which is, you know, just as important, and filled that gap, basically. Looked at what other people had done, like this one, for example. I'd seen this a lot on internal cat sort of like furniture, where you get a lot of people who cat-proof a room in the house.
Okay.
They'd rather do it like that. And things like that are a lot more apparent. But this particular build, it was a 12-foot by 8-foot shed. And then I built a 12-foot by 12-foot catio on the side of it, which allowed me to use certain features that wouldn't normally be feasible on the outside. Like that one, for example, that's just made out of 18mm ply, basically. But it's one I've been wanting to do for ages, like a hexagon ladder, because it looks completely different.
Yeah,
it's a lot different from using the diagonal stepping pegs and ramps and things like that. But it's more enriching for them because they can hop and skip between them. They can bat at each other, which is what those two were doing more often than not, because one wanted to get up and the other one wouldn't let it. And it's just providing different enrichment for them as well. But also it's a different aesthetic for the pet owners to look at as well, because it needs to be for everybody.
I really like that picture with the yeah. lighting. Was that your idea, the lighting, or the from the customer?
I've seen lighting before, and I thought that's something I need to really capitalize on, really. But I mean, I basically just bought a big stock of lights, and I showed it to the client. I says, you know, this is an option as well if you want it to, because it was quite a dark spot, and they were just like, well, yeah, we'll take 6 lights then. So basically just, you know, put them on these little magnetic RGB remote controlled lights, so you can change the colors, you can make them cycle through all the different colors, you can change the luminosity, and it just completely transforms the space. Okay, yeah. You know,
that shows up well then in the dark.
Yeah, that's it. You know, so it's just adding a different aesthetic to it, and just, you know, making it just enriching for everybody.
How do you pick up your work?
Generally social media.
Okay.
Yeah, social media is the number one tool for businesses, I think. It's free. At the very least, it is free, and you're basically connected to everybody worldwide. It's you know, an advertiser's dream, to be honest.
Is that what made you start on social media? Were you interested in social media naturally before you started the business, or?
Not particularly, no. On a personal level, social media for me, it's just a way of keeping in touch with people that don't really, you know, you don't really speak to on the day-to-day basis. But business-wise, I'm very busy on social media, that aspect. But yeah, personally, I just, you know, I understood it was, you know, you're a fool if you don't use it for a business. You know, if you just do the traditional stuff like advertising, magazines, radio and TV, stuff like that, and don't use social media, you're really, you know, bottlenecking your footprint, you know, and it's just, if you don't use it, you're daft. You know.
Do you think the trade use it enough?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some businesses use it, and I've just thought, you know, I wouldn't have done that if I were you. You know, it's because I've seen some businesses where they've posted, you know, ender a job, and they've used either these really poor photos, or they've done it in a way that people, like, you look at the comments, and all the comments are really negative, like, oh, that looks horrendous and all this sort of stuff. And then they start getting defensive in replies and things like that.
It's a good thing, but can be a mess.
Oh, yeah.
When it goes wrong.
Yeah, you just need to make sure, you need to really scrutinize what you've put and think.
How would you...
Is that going to work?
When we've done customer research on our kind of builders merchants customer base.
Yeah.
And the age range does tend to be quite old in a builder's merchant.
Yeah.
45 and upwards would be our kind of core age. And I guess we're the same in most builder's merchants. Mm. Obviously, social media is a different generation to that generation.
Yeah.
If you're going to give some advice to somebody in that kind of 40 to 55 bracket on how to start up on social media, could you give any advice?
Yeah, just don't be proud to defer to someone else who's a subject matter expert, whether it's, you know, if it's someone younger or someone who does it for a living. Just tap into their experience. You know, it's, you don't have to solo everything and be self-taught all the time. I mean, it's like we anything, you know, you if there's somebody that you can get advice from and better yourself from it, then just do it.
Take it.
You know, because I mean, like, I hired a videographer last year because I do all my own photos and videos. I tend not to use videos because they just never turn out how I want them to. Yeah. So I thought for August last year, I had my first sort of like high profile customer. And I thought, you know, it's middle of August, the weather's going to be absolutely belting. So I thought, right, I'm going to hire this videographer that one of my clients who's an amateur bodybuilder uses all the time, him and his cousins. And I thought, right, I'll book him in. and he can do me some really good content, and then I can fire that on the new year. Because I worked from August last year, I was right up to the new year. I was fully booked, and I thought, if I use it in August, people are just going to be not willing to wait. So I thought, right, I'll use that to boost 2025. And I tell you, I'm glad I did, you know, because he just, yeah, there were draws and all sorts. And the post-production he did and the editing and all that was...
It's interesting. It's an interesting point. Yeah. Like about don't be afraid to ask because you don't know where it gets you.
Yeah.
That's why you're sat here.
Yeah.
Because your note to us was, yes. I've seen it. I really liked it. It was interesting.
Yeah.
Would there be any way I could...
Yeah, exactly.
You weren't saying, you didn't say, can I come on?
Yeah.
You just said, what could I do to be involved?
Yeah, exactly. Because
that inquisitive mindset.
Yeah. Honestly.
What is the right, is a really good one to adopt generally.
You don't ask, you don't get.
No.
You know, so, I mean, it's, you know, it's great for me because, you know, I can use this on my social media and put it out there, and people just generally just see me posting pictures of my work and all that sort of stuff and get to know a bit more about me and all that sort of stuff. But also it's developing a rapport between me and you guys, because I mean, I've predominantly used you guys since I started, you know, and it's the podcast itself. I mean, nobody else is doing no other builders and merchants are doing podcasts. And it just solidifies things as well.
It's interesting the response you're getting off your social media. I mean, you were giving me some numbers before we start. You've got over 4,000 followers on Facebook.
Yeah.
You've got 1,500 on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
You've got just over 200 on TikTok. Albeit we talked about TikTok, and you're saying it's probably targeted at the younger generations.
Yeah.
And it's quite intense because it needs a lot of content.
Yeah, it does.
They're nice numbers. And I remember when we met up, it was the first time we met just to see what we could do.
Yeah.
I think you said you'd had 20 WhatsApps that day.
Yeah.
From all over the world asking about things.
So yeah.
You're getting inquiries from all over the world.
Oh, yeah, because there's some people don't realise I'm based in the UK. So they'll be like, you know, people from like Canada, Saudi Arabia, Australia, all over the place, the US, nice. Europe.
And are they people that have found you on Instagram and Facebook?
Yeah, it's predominantly cat groups from Facebook because they're like, you know, international, all that sort of stuff. Well, I get absolutely all sorts of inquiries from all over the world. But I remember last year we did a annual deployment exercise in Germany. And I put it on my business page.
This was in the Army Reserve.
Army Reserve, yeah. So you have to do one every year. And I was in Sennelager in Germany last year. And I put it on my business page, like, right, I'm off to do the Army thing for 2 weeks. I'll be back in touch with everyone when I get back. And somebody from the Netherlands messaged me and said, oh, whilst you're on your way to Germany, would you mind stopping off and building me a catio? And so, oh, yeah, I'll get off at coach, you know, no tools or anything like that. But, yeah, I'll see what I can throw together for you. Like, yeah, don't worry about it, mate.
So you made some really... strange contacts from all over the world.
All over the world, but it's just because people don't realise that, you know, I'm UK based. I mean, I try to, you know, get that across, but, you know,
What's your plans for the future then with the business?
So the plans are basically just keep innovating, keep things fresh, keep current, and just keep enjoying the process, because, you know, that's the important thing for me, is that I enjoy what I do, because if I don't enjoy it, then it becomes a chore, and then you stop trying to push the envelope as regards to just keeping things up and current and just keeping ideas brand new and all that sort of stuff. And that's my main goal. I mean, you know, I need to obviously keep making money and being able to have, like, you know, like food to eat and stuff like that. But yeah, it'd be nice to expand at some point, because I'm going to be starting to hit like a natural glass ceiling as regards to what I can do.
I can't do anymore.
Yeah, whether or not that's getting people to do the social media side, or if it's getting like another time served journey with the same interests and same sort of like values as me to help me along, you know, it's who knows. But I'm not at that point yet. We're still sort of early days really with the business. I'm still like, you know, learning about, you know, the business itself and myself in the process. So yeah, I'd say that's the goals for me, you know, that sort of stuff.
Good luck with it. So what we'll do, we'll make sure we share all your contact details
in
the across all of our socials and in the notes for all of all of this. So really good luck with that.
Sorry.
Keep you moving on. It's your turn to help us. Some talk about builders merchant.
Yeah, yeah.
What's good about builders merchant? Mm-hmm. What's bad about builders merchant?
Yeah.
When do we really help you? Mm-hmm. When do we cause you loads of blooming problems?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also around how you see the future of biomaterials.
Yeah.
Do you see a future for builders merchants, or is it all going to go online eventually? So yeah. What's good about the builders merchants industry?
So it's when you start to get an understanding for your materials, you know what to expect. So when you start building a rapport with a builders merchant, you generally know what they have, when they have it, and you just develop that confidence in them. And you know when you turn up, you're going to be like, right, I know that they're going to have all that tooby-tooing. I know it's not going to look like an hockey stick, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And especially when you get to know the staff as well, whether that's like, you know, you guys or other builders merchants, you know that they're going to have your best interests and you can go in knowing that you're not going to get fleeced or whatever, and what you're buying is appropriately priced and all that sort of stuff. And I feel like if you develop a good rapport with them, that's really good. The flip side is when I'm working out of area and I've got to use like down south, and I can't
it's people that you don't know.
Yeah, I feel like you know, they might be pulling wool over your eyes a bit, because like, oh, he's, you know, this northern's just tipped up and he's like, oh, you know, well, he's ordered all this stuff, let's, you know, we'll just get rid of some of it, you know,
rubbish,
yeah,
and charge him twice as much.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's,
yes, and you've experienced that.
Yeah, I've experienced that, where I've had to take stuff back and I'm just like, you know, do you want to have a look down at length of this timber, what's wrong with this picture, you know, that sort of stuff. Or it might be timber that's been left exposed to the sun and it's gone grey or whatever, and you know, because a lot of it's exposed, it's not like it's going to be a stud wall or whatever. That, you know, it don't matter if it's like that, but when a customer's paid like a couple of grand for an enclosure, they don't want to be looking at, you know, where timber's gone grey, you can see strap marks or burn marks where it's been machined, or, you know, all that sort of stuff, or the print that you get, you know, where it says like C24 or whatever. They don't want to be seeing stuff like that, and that's why I tend to go and pick stuff up myself, because I can scrutinise it and really be selective.
But do you think that's the USP then of a builder's merchant? The people, the good people who,
yeah,
in a funny way, almost become a silent partner in your business.
Yeah, they do.
You know, they've got your back, and they're 100%. Trying to do the right things.
Yeah, they underpin that relationship between customer and builder's merchant, because especially with a family-based builder's merchant, because the family values transpose onto the business and it permeates through it on all levels, at least I feel like, anyway. Because when I go into Thorn Ranch, which is my go-to branch, I mean, there's one in Doncaster, but I prefer to go to Thorn because they have the lengths that I need.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like I've got a fantastic relationship with the people who were there, whether it's lads in yards, you know, whether it's branch manager, guys on desk, you know, or like might have a rep that comes out, visits me every once in a while, see if there's anything else that can be done, or if there's anything specific that I need. It's fantastic. I know I could go in not having issues.
Could you ever see a time when there's no need for a builder's merchant and we just buy everything online?
No, definitely not. I think builder's merchants will always be there as a physical location to go and get stuff, because it's not just myself. I feel like a lot of people do it as well. They'll go and they'll want to select materials themselves because, you know, they're paying money for it.
Yeah.
They want to get the best stuff, you know. So, like, you know, there's no more annoying when you've got everything organised and your timber's been delivered the day before job starts or whatever, and you get there and, you know, all corners are smashed off at plasterboard or something, or the timber's all, you know, warped and all that sort of stuff, or, you know, you know, things like that. And you just think, you know what, if I'd have gone and picked it myself, this wouldn't happen. Now I've got to go and faff around sorting that out. But yeah, I think physical locations always be valid, because, you know, you might have people going and they've got no experience whatsoever and be like, what size screw is this? I've seen that loads of times. Sweet old lady turning with like a screw from 40s, like, oh, how big is that? Have you got any of these? And, you know, you need that for people who are not savvy with the materials or trades, because they'll need walking through the entire process, like, you know, I want some timber to do this, what should I have? Or, you know, they might have questions about other stuff, you know, whether it's...
So not wanting to put you on the spot. Well, I do want to put you on the spot in a nice way.
Yeah.
If there was one thing you could change about builders merchants, one change you could make that would make a builders merchants even better.
Yeah.
Would you have one?
Yeah, well, there's a minor one that I definitely would change, and that's parking. That winds me up so much. When I turn up, I want to buy like 600, 700 cruisers of timber, and I can't get it in yard, so it's got to be handballed all the way to the car park at the back of the building because somebody decided to block the yard off to buy one bag of sharps or something like that.
Well, that's a real problem at Fulham, for us in particular,
yeah,
because it's a really...
Yeah,
you know, it's really
it is a bit of a small... Yeah, but it's a small price.
Well, is there anything... So that's really specific to...
Yeah, that's very, very specific.
Is there anything you could think of, generally speaking, if you could wave a magic wand, something that would make... build the builders merchant industry even better for you?
The thing that I would definitely change would be sort of like the international climate affecting prices. Remember when that ship got trapped in the Panama Canal? That had a massive knock-on effect and everything went up. You know, things like conflicts and all that sort of stuff.
We just had the Red Sea is causing problems because it's making people having to... ships having to go around.
Yeah, exactly.
Africa.
And also when there's conflicts in the Middle East and people start panicking, the price of fuel goes up, you know, that affects builders and merchants because ultimately transportation, you know, you've got that affects things like that.
So you think then we should be making sure that our supply chain is stronger to account for those kinds of problems?
Yeah, basically that'd be fantastic. A more resilient and more robust supply chain that can deal with that, because it's very, very fragile. And we found that out during COVID,
didn't we?
You know, as soon as the tap gets turned off for certain things, it's like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
What do we do now? You know, and it would just, you know, it causes chaos. But yeah, if things were just a bit more resilient and more adaptable, that'd be mega. I mean, obviously it's not going to happen because ultimately that cost has got to filter down to customer. I mean, as much as I do try and absorb little changes, I mean, I really don't mind doing that. But then, say, for example, if I go to book a hotel or I go to order roof sheets or something like that, and they're like, actually, it's gone up now. I'm like, great, I'm going to have to ask the customer if they still want to proceed, you know. Because I never said to them, like, oh, by the way, this is cost extra, this is what you need to pay now. I always ask them, like, look, this is the change, unfortunately. Things have gone up since we quoted. Are you still happy to go ahead, yes or no? You know, because I don't want them to feel like I'm just, you know, deciding to act on for laugh.
If we can't mitigate those problems, it just causes you the problem at the front end.
Yeah.
If you've got to swallow it.
Yeah.
Or you potentially lose the job.
Yeah, exactly. And it has happened in the past where customers said, well, actually, it's out of budget now. I can't afford that. And, you know, but that's just the nature of the beast where, you know, it's...
That's good.
But you've got to be open and honest with your customers, haven't
you? Yeah, right, I'm going to start with wrapping us up.
Yeah.
Always have a quick fire question session that finishes every one of our podcasts so far, just to get some views and opinions of people on various things.
Yeah.
I've slightly modified these for you because you're not one of us, you're one of our customers.
Yeah.
So I've got on to four questions.
Right.
Hopefully they'll not catch you out. What's the favourite part of your job?
Being creative, being able to exercise that creativity and just scratch that itch and just think, you know what, I'm going to try this idea.
Do you think that creativity thing comes from the music that was your initial career path?
I think it comes from the autism.
Right.
Yeah, I think it definitely comes from that because I've got a slightly different lens or a view of life through compared to other people who are like neurotypical. But it also...
How long have you known about your autism?
It was March 2023. When I was diagnosed.
Recently.
Very, very, very recent. Up until that point, I thought I was just not wired up properly.
Yeah, but differently, not properly.
Yeah, but you know, I use that as, I basically just weaponize it and I use it as an avenue to really sort of
weaponize,
like...
Weaponize one of your super skills.
Yeah, well, that's it, you know. I mean, it's got its downside, but ayo, that's life, you know. Okay.
The worst part of your job?
Rain. I'm getting rained off at the moment.
A horrific start to the year.
Honestly, I'm currently working in Stocksbridge, and the only thing separating me from Peak District is a hedge.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, there's literally the other side of edges of Peak District, and it's just absolutely driving in at the moment, so that's a standstill.
What about, I thought you'd say something like paperwork.
Oh, no. No.
You like paperwork, do you?
No, I don't like paperwork, but I don't enjoy it either. It's just, it's a necessity you've got to deal with. It's just a case of caffeine. And, you know, heavy metal.
Don't procrastinate, get it done.
Yeah, just get it done.
And then, if you don't do paperwork, you don't get paid, do you? So it's
yeah, that's it, yeah.
What's the most crucial trait a tradesman needs to possess?
Honesty, I'd say.
Can I expand?
Yeah, definitely be honest. Just be open and honest with your customers. Don't, you know, you need to establish that you're going to do them right, and the quote that you're giving them is true, that you're not out there to absolutely squeeze them for every last, you know, penny that they've got.
Yeah.
And you need to ensure that the product that you give them is a quality product that they've asked for. You know, because when I've had people in to do work on my house or something like that, and I said, oh, how much to plaster this room? And they'll be like, oh, it'll be between, I don't know, 600 to 800 quid. And I'm like, well, is it 600 or 800, you know? Which is like, when I give me quotes to my customers, it's down to a penny, because I work out absolutely everything.
Every screw.
And that is literally it. And I'm like, right, this is what it's going to cost you. I don't like the customers to feel like I'm being dishonest or anything like that. I think that's absolutely crucial. You need to be trustworthy and you need to be honest, because otherwise your word of mouth recommendations are not going to...
That's a really good, you know. And then the final one for you, best piece of advice you've ever been given.
Best piece of advice was what my platoon sergeant gave me. Don't let sleep be a barrier to success. You know, so more often than not in army, you get fastballed with stuff, when, you know, like when you're on courses or something like that. You might get an instructor come in your room at the last minute, be like, oh, right, you're doing this tomorrow, lads. Make sure this, and this is ready. So next thing you know, you're up until small hours, making sure everything's prepped, everything's good to go. And then you'll be like, right, I'm going to get 3 hours sleep now. And then we're going to be up all day. You know, it's same in trades. You know, if you need to stay up late to make sure things are in good order for when the job starts, then do it. You know, if it means you've got to have a couple of early nights to catch up, then do it, you know. But yeah, just don't let sleep be a barrier to getting it where things running properly, you know.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
We've not had that one before. When we put our book together of everybody's best piece of advice, yeah, that'd be good. Listen, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
Having you, I've really enjoyed, you know, the conversation and, you know, the whole story with your life and your career and all the changes.
Yeah.
Good luck with everything that you do with Catio King.
Ah, well, thank you very much.
More knowledgeable now about what it is. I hope it's a great success for you moving forward. So we will share, as I said, we will share all of your contact details on podcasts and notes and any promotional stuff we do with it. To you, our listeners, thanks for joining us again. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. If you have enjoyed it, it would be great if you could like and subscribe. It'd be great if you could spread the word to anybody else that you know who you think might be interested in this. I think we've got some good stories in our industry. And this has been another great one. So thank you all for listening. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for watching. We'll see you again in the future. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.